Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, we have Jonathan Mooney on the podcast. Jonathan is a dyslexic writer and speaker who did not learn to read until 12 years old. He faced a number of low expectations growing up, was told he would flip burgers, be a high school dropout, and end up in jail. Needless to say, these prophecies didn't come to pass. Today, he speaks across the nation about neurological and physical diversity, inspiring those who live with differences and advocating for change. Mooney's work has been featured in outlets such as the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, HBO, NPR, and ABC News. And his books include The Short Bus, Learning Outside the Lines, and most recently, Normal Sucks, How to Live, Learn, and Thrive Outside the Lines. So great to finally have you on the Psychology Podcast, Jonathan.
Oh, hey, man, I'm a big fan of the podcast and your work, and really honored to be a part of your program today.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad we could have this chat, especially around the release of this new book of yours, which is just a really terrific book and really questions a lot of things a lot of people take for granted as assumptions.
Yeah, and it also has a very subtle title.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, no need to pull punches. Let's just kind of get right to the point.
For sure. But, you know, as I'm reading the book, I'm thinking, you know, you do such a good job unpacking the idea that there really is no such thing as normality. And then you say that normal sucks. And I just wanted to just like straight up ask you, like, how do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah, I mean, you're right to note that the project – the book, and I say project because it transcends the book, but it kind of came to a distillation in the book, is about coming to the conclusion that there is no such thing as normal. But the problem is that we still have a notion of normal that is very dominant in our culture and becomes institutionalized in our systems, school, work, and beyond. So while the reality is that the only normal people are people you don't know very well, that it is a myth, it's still a powerful construct that looms over people's lives. And that construct is real in people's lives and needed to be challenged and rejected and ultimately deconstructed so we can make something new.
Yes, you're trying to make something new. So in your ideal world, what would the sort of reconceptualization be from if we eradicated the whole notion of normal, would that also mean we'd have to eradicate the notion of neurodiversity?
It's an interesting question.
Logically that we would.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question because what you're positing, and for your listeners who I think are well versed in this, and you're referencing, which is a movement of people who have contested the pathologizing of their brains, and they've reframed their brain neurological experience not as a deficit or disorder, but as a form of human diversity. The pathologizing of certain brains comes from the notion that there is a normal brain that one can differ from. So I look at this in an arc of sort of resistance, right? So while we can fast forward, and those of us who spend a lot of time with the research, listening to wonderful podcasts like this and others, we know that the notion of a normal and subsequently an abnormal, a typical and a different, are artificial constructs. We have to meet those constructs where we are now. So I see in the short term a desperate need still for the neurodiversity framework, because there is still a framework of normal, not normal, abnormal that is embedded in our textbooks, embedded in our language, embedded in our systems. So it is an act of courage and resistance and an act of healing and empowerment to claim states of being that have historically been considered abnormal as forms of differences. But you are right. If we can look ahead to the medium horizon or maybe the long-term horizon, if we can look ahead to a world where the notion of normal has been abandoned, we can see that difference is the human condition. You know, there's a part of the book in which I write about a set of brain scans that have been happening at the NIH, National Institute of Health. And the brain scans set out to find the normal brain as a way to intervene around mental behavior health challenges. And the head of that study is quoted as saying, as a result of the scans, you could not find a normal brain. So again, down the road, that's where we got to get. But in the short term, you know, I'm a proud advocate, soldier for the notion of neurodiversity. And we all need to fight for that construct while it's useful now, but ultimately imagine the world where there is no bifurcation, polarization between the normal and the not.
Yeah, it's a good world to imagine. I also am a proponent for neurodiversity, and I'd hate to have to delete the hashtag from my Twitter bio, pound neurodiversity. Okay, cool. So I want to just like go back a second. No, not go back. Second, go back a long time to your childhood. And you know, both me and you, there's some overlap in the story. So obviously, I resonate a lot with your story, and my heart goes out a lot to your early childhood experiences. And I also recognize how hard it can be to just tell the story. Like I think I've probably told my story over 1,000 times in the last 3 years, and maybe you have told your own personal story even more than that. But do you mind talking a little bit about it again with me right now for a new audience?
Everything I do around my advocacy work comes directly from my personal experience. You know, I, as you mentioned in your introduction, I was the, you know, the peg that didn't fit the hole of school. And as a result of that, you know, suffered tremendously. I spent a lot of the time because I couldn't sit still, chilling out with the janitor in the hallway. I spent a lot of time on a first name basis with Shirley, the receptionist in the principal's office. And I spent a lot of the day hiding in the bathroom to escape reading out loud with tears streaming down my face. Those struggles made me feel that I wasn't different, but deficient. Those struggles and that marginalization, and I think we should call it what it is. It is a form of marginalization for a manifestation of human difference. When people with atypical brains are made to feel not different, but deficient.
You said by the end of the third grade, I was promoted from being one of those kids to the resource room special ed kid. I was diagnosed with multiple language-based learning disabilities and attention deficit disorder. I was in the resource room, too. I thought that was interesting that that's what they called it where you were as well. It wasn't called special ed in my where I was. It was called the resource room. Was that similar with you as well?
Yeah, I found myself in a variety of different and if we were in person, you'd see my air quotes, alternative education settings,
right.
You know, the resource room being one of those. Spent more directly named special education specific programs at different parts of my journey were another part of my experience. But all of those, to go back to the air quotes, all of those spaces were stigmatizing, you know, the number of times I was called, you know, a retard, or the number of times I was called stupid because of being placed in that sort of space. And I think it's interesting. I think a lot about the kind of structural role of special education. And I have a lot of cognitive dissonance around that. You know, on one hand, it was an act of tremendous change and empowerment in 1973 when the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act was passed. You know, before that, folks with different brains and bodies had no right to an education. They could be excluded and were excluded at staggering numbers. So the creation of the resource room, the special ed room, all those things was an act of inclusion at first. But like anything else, there are unintended consequences. And one of those unintended consequences is when we sort of walled off a group of people with atypical brains and bodies, when we saw them through the lens of pathology opposed to diversity, because most of those folks have labels and diagnoses that get them into that space, we've essentially gave a message to all the other kids about individuality. You know, to be different is to be deficient. And we let the system off the hook. We said, okay, personalized, differentiated instruction happens over there for those kids. But everybody else, hey, you better be normal or else.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a really excellent point. I've been trying to think, you know, thinking about my own childhood and then sort of my own person. Like, people keep asking me, like, what was your, like, why did you fight the system? Like, and other people in special ed kind of resigned to their fate in some ways. And I keep trying to think, like, what is the personality trait? Like, what is that about? And I actually I don't like it when people ask me that question, but I'm sure you get asked that question too. When you were young, you know, I read these things, like you were reading this report and like, and you like were cursing them out after every one of these things, like, Jonathan displays poor executive, my God, I'll kill them function, you know? And I was reading this and I was like, well, I wanted to ask you, like, why did it bother you so much that people said you were deficient? I really have been trying to unpack that for a long time, because it bothered me too. But it didn't bother everyone. I have my own hypotheses, and before I tell you, I wanted to get your own thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, look, my journey of, agency and efficacy and empowerment was a journey, and I say that to mean that I struggled with wearing helplessness around those labels and believing that they were right about me, and then subsequently had support in resisting it. You know, when I was first diagnosed at the end of third grade. You know, me and my mom went into the school psychologist's office, and it was obvious that everyone in the room thought we were getting like the worst news in the world. You know, like there was like soft music playing in the background, and there was like a box of tissues on the table, you know, and all of the language they used in front of me, you know, was Jonathan has deficit this, disorder this, Jonathan can't do this, can't do that. And so I remember walking out of that room and turning to my mom, and my mom's quite a character. You know, she's like 4'9" on a good day and high heels on her tippy toes. And she has a very squeaky, high-pitched voice like Minnie Mouse, and she curses like a truck driver. And if you were a teacher doing wrong by her son, you did not want cursing Minnie Mouse in your office, you know, but that's where my mom was. She was that person who believed in me. So I walked out of the shrink's office and said to my mom, hey mom, am I normal? And my mom said, Jonathan, normal sucks. And that's actually the origin.
Oh, wow. Your mom said that to you. Okay.
That's actually the origin of the title. Now, I didn't believe my mom at the time, you know, I was like, whatever, mom, normal's better than what I am. But she planted that seed.
I see.
And that scene that you were alluded to when we were reading the report, which happened a little bit later after the diagnosis at a cafe in Manhattan Beach where I grew up, my mom was reading that out loud, and she was the one actually freaking out and saying all of these profanities and
I see. That was your mom's words.
That was my mom.
Oh, speaking. I'm sorry for misunderstanding that.
No. But you are right that my mom was the person who was the voice of resistance and defiance well before I could be that voice. Mm-hmm. And then of course I had others along that journey, my mom being one. I had many gifted educators, and it's important for me to celebrate them, who not only tended to my learning needs, but also enforced that notion and supported that notion that nothing was wrong with me, that it was wrong the way I was being treated, and that ultimately I should fight back.
Yeah, I mean, just reading that, I was just like fascinated by the parallels. That was around the time I was diagnosed, and then I repeated third grade as a result. Did they ask you to repeat third grade?
I wasn't asked to repeat third grade. I left school in it for a time in sixth grade after being accused of plagiarizing something that I had not. And then because, you know, of course, you know, if you're dyslexic, you can't also be a good writer. That was the framework that people had. And I had written dictated and I stumble over the distinction between writing and dictating, because I have really come to believe that there is no distinction, that talking something is as valid as writing something. And in our age of speech to text, I think the false dichotomy between sort of writing and dictating will hopefully start to crumble. But I dictated this story to my mom and was accused of plagiarizing it, because they only knew me through the lens of the bad spelling and the bad handwriting and the monosyllabic sentences when I was forced to write in a traditional way. So I contemplated repeating sixth grade, and then again, we contemplated and came close to repeating ninth grade. But I sort of stayed on the timetable, mostly with the goal of kind of getting out as soon as.
Yeah, get the heck out of there. I feel you, brother. Like, I think it's so important what you're doing. And you touched on this notion of like, oh, well, obviously, like, you can't be a gifted writer and have trouble spelling, right? But like, you know, this emerging movement of 2E, twice exceptional, which is where my heart lies the most these days. I'm really glad to kind of see that movement go, but it's still a minority movement. I mean, I don't think most educators have heard of twice exceptional children.
They haven't. You know, I gave my first talk for Sue Baum.
A legend, by the way.
Let's celebrate Sue as loud as we can.
Yeah. And,
gave my first talk on her behalf. She invited me after my first book, Learning Outside the Lines, came out in 2000.
Wow.
And I had no idea what the hell this 2E thing was, you know. But I was so invigorated by it at first for very personal reasons. You know, I actually have never shared this story before. So this is the first time I'm doing so. Not for any, you know, reason I haven't, you know, I don't know why, but this is the first time I've shared it out loud. So when I was a kid, at the same time that I was struggling in school in sixth grade, fifth and sixth grade, you know, was really seen through a narrow lens. You know, the smart kid could read fast, the smart kid could write, et cetera. There was something in California called the GATE program, which was the gifted and talented program. Mm. And I remember the day like it was yesterday, where the five kids from my class got pulled out to the GATE program. Mm. And it was such a stark juxtaposition between the SPED room that I was going to a resource room, and then the GATE program, meaning the SPED room was all about trying to make the square peg fit the round hole, right? We were going to remediate my spelling. We were going to remediate my reading. It was fix it, fix it, fix it, fix it. And then I watched these other kids walk down into this room that looked like a straight up like maker's lab. You know what I mean? And this is like 1984, you know, no one had ever done this before. And I was so pissed off, man.
Yeah.
And it was such a visceral moment of a sense of inequity and a sense of why do, you know, me and this group of kids get fixed all day long, and that small group gets amplified, accelerated. They get to do passion and interest-driven project. And so when I went to the 2E world, I was really resentful, maybe one word, more skeptical of the whole notion of giftedness and how we define it. And what I found in the 2E world was a radical definition of what we think of as giftedness, as human flourishing, challenging a very narrow definition of giftedness that conflates gifted with school performance. Because the reality right. is some of the most gifted people are people who don't perform in school. We know more than ever that, you know, true giftedness comes hand in hand with a complicated brew of strengths and weaknesses, of assets and challenges. And I'm such a believer in the power of the 2E movement to recognize the talent that is going unrecognized, of course, but ultimately to lead a movement that has a broader definition of human flourishing that empowers more and more types of human beings to find what's right with them and build a life around it.
Absolutely. Very well said. Well, it's good to have you as part as a champion of the 2E movement. Could have someone as such as your position having an advocate. I wonder how we can get more prominent advocates of it. First of all, we just have to get the word out more about it.
We have to get the word out more about it, and then you know we have to stop faking normal, all of us, you know, like because, you know, let me give an example of that. You know, I went to Brown University, and I'm sure you, and I know you, and I'm sure most of your listeners know that that's, you know, some Ivy League school. And when I transferred to Brown, and so I went to a university before Brown on soccer scholarship. And that's really all I thought I could be. I thought all I could be is an athlete. I was the stupid, crazy, lazy kid. And that was my sort of island of competency survival mechanism through adolescence. And then through a very sort of dramatic set of changes in my life, I got involved in my education, advocated for myself, got the services that I deserved, and decided to transfer to Brown. And so when I got to Brown, I really felt like I had no place. You know, here I was, the resource room kid. I kind of faked my way through as a soccer player. I felt like a fraud there.
Yes.
And I remember when we first got on campus, me and my mom, there was a transfer orientation and there was an icebreaker. And the icebreaker was share where you transferred from and what you did the summer before. And so the moment the first kid went, it was like brag fest time, you know, it was like, oh, I transferred from, you know, Yale, and I worked at the National Institute of Health, and I transferred from Harvard, and I'm on a short list for a Nobel Prize, you know, it was just brag fest. And, you know, I was like, I'm out of here, you know, I got no place here. I felt not normal there. And then a guy raised his hand, I'll never forget this. He had purple hair. And he had bicycle chains around his wrists like they were bracelets. And he said, my name is David Cole, and I transferred from Landmark College, which is a two-year college for people with learning and attentional differences. And I worked construction last summer. Mm. I'm like, that's my boy right there, you know? And I went right up to him. And he was the first person that I had ever seen stop trying to fake normal.
Right.
And it changed my life, you know. You fast forward, Dave Cole co-authored Learning Outside the Lines. Dave Cole co-founded Eye to Eye. And Dave Cole is now a renowned conceptual artist, sculptor, doing amazing work. All your listeners should go check him out online, and an advocate for the neurodiverse. But my point is, I would have left that school. I would have felt alone if he hadn't had the courage to share his different, you know? And so I think a part of like being an advocate and building awareness for this is obviously for us to advocate in the traditional sense of asking systems to recognize 2E, but it's also about us recognizing the 2E inside of ourselves and having the courage to share that out with the world, to colleagues, to people we work with, to family members, to not hide the things that make us different, but to celebrate those. And when we do that, we build a more inclusive world, and we are true advocates for diversity in the broadest sense.
You said that you have this quote, you said, don't get me wrong, normal is a force of repression for sure, but it is also a source of creation. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, for me, normal was pressing down upon me, you know, and as it does us, with a set of restrictions, do this, don't do this, be this way, don't be that way. Learn this way, don't learn that way. And it's an all-encompassing sort of imperative to be normal, or as one of the titles of one of the chapters is, act normal, right? But what's interesting to me, and it gets to the quote that you reference, which comes from that chapter, act normal. I don't think we realize what hypocrisy it is to tell people to act normal, because to act is to fundamentally play a role, something you are not, right? Mm-hmm. And when you play that role, not only are you engaged in, you know, the sort of repression side of normal, but you're also creating something, a role, a persona, a self, that may or may not be you. And that was said within a particular part of my journey, helping me understand my journey, where I was told to act normal relentlessly all the time. Sit still, don't talk so fast, don't talk so loud, write better. And so I decided to act normal in the highest sense. You know, I took on this persona of being the athlete person. I mean, you all can imagine that in your mind. Took on the kind of persona of hiding all of my differences, doing the opposite of what Dave Cole did, you know, 10 years later in my life. And ultimately took on the role of enforcing normalcy on others and telling other people how they should be or shouldn't be, demeaning other people with a continuum of differences around sexuality, sexual orientation, race, class, gender. And ultimately it was a force of repression, but creation, and it created a self that was built on a very fragile foundation, and eventually that foundation broke.
So some of that instance, it doesn't sound like you were trying to be normal. It sounds like you were overcompensating, like you were trying to be great, like super extra great. It feels a little different to me than trying to be normal. It felt like an overcompensation. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I go back and forth between how we use the word normal, because
right
you know, the and because you're right, in its most clear linguistical sense, normal is the middle of the bell curve,
correct,
or the average, and in its sort of social history, that's where the concept became widely understood within culture. You know, it emerged within the discipline of the statistics, the whole notion of the average man that emerged with a Belgian statistician in the sort of 1840s, 1850s. And the average became held up as the optimal. But what's interesting, and if you look at the work of a man that I really admire, he's a mentor of mine, in Leonard Davis, he wrote a book called Enforcing Normalcy. Mm. In around the 1880s, the average got conflated with the ideal, which is something that's kind of impossible, right? Mm. And that's where this normal as both average, but also the impossible ideal kind of looms all over us. So I think, to go to your question, I was not trying to be typical in the sense of the middle of the bell curve. I was trying to overcompensate, you know, be exceptional in yeah. some way. But that was in its own right a capitulation to the complicated mess of normalcy in our world. Let me give you a good example of that complicated mess. You know, in the 1940s, a movement, and frankly, they were eugenicists that did this, but a movement of pseudoscientists, et cetera, took a group of body measurements that happened in many different areas, measurements of bodies. They were non-representational measurements. They were mostly white people, mostly upper middle class, et cetera. And then they created sculptures of these people called Norma and Norman. Literally, this is not a joke. Everyone can look this up. They created the sculptures of Norman and Norma.
Right.
And these sculptures were supposedly of the normal human beings, but then when you looked at them, they were like the Statue of David. And in Cleveland, they held a competition to find women who looked like Norma. And those women submitted their body measurements. And of course, surprise, surprise, nobody met the body measurements of this so-called normal representation. So normal is an impossible ideal, but it's an impossible ideal that we're told to be and to keep chasing into the horizon.
Yeah, that's a great example of that. When it comes to intelligence, intelligence is, boy, that's what a tricky topic that is. And I started off studying it in my career being like, oh, IQ is like evil, to like studying it and realizing, well, there are real individual differences in IQ, and it's a real thing. Like there's some people that are really high on that bell curve and are able to learn really quickly in a school kind of environment. And so when we talk about other these kind of psychological constructs, they certainly can scientifically be captured, right?
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting you mentioned your journey with IQ, because I think I've probably gone on a comparable journey, but not from a scholarly perspective, but from an activist perspective. And, you know, you're right to note that we have to value difference, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Can't wave it away, you know what I mean? And we
can't say it exists and doesn't exist at the same time.
Exactly right. Now, to the question that started our amazing dialogue around the notion of, you know, saying normal sucks, but then arguing that it's a construct, you know, we have to be tactical in our moments, right? You know what I mean? And we have to understand that to get to a North Star place where, you know, certain differences can be not pathologized but celebrated, we have to do X, Y, and Z in our sort of social activism and intellectual activism. But to go to your question around intelligence and what you're noting is exactly right. I don't take issue with the idea that given this psychometric assessment of intelligence, but we could apply it to others, that there are deviations on a bell curve around that. That is true. That there's not a continuum of aptitudes, etc. What I take issue with is then the value judgment that's placed on it from a cultural perspective. So to call, you know, one type of human who excels because of a certain cognitive predisposition in a certain system, the smart human,
right, is
to call all the other people who don't the dumb human. And so I think what we need to be mindful of is valuing difference, not demeaning the manifestation of intelligence that is captured in IQ. That manifestation of intelligence has value. It does, and it contributes to the world. But at the same time, we can't demean the manifestations of intelligence that aren't captured in that tool. And we can have a broader definition, like Sternberg does and others, that starts to surface up the multiple manifestations of human flourishing. And then we have to have systems that don't just call one brain smart, but create room for all of those brains that have something right with them to be recognized and empowered as well.
Yeah, that was really very well put. That was why I had the cheeky title of my book called Ungifted. I don't know if you ever had a chance to read that book.
Yeah, man, I'm a big fan of it.
Oh, cool. Well, I'm honored. You know, there's just a cheeky way of saying, like, if we have the gifted, doesn't that mean that there exists a class of human beings called the ungifted?
And, right.
Yeah. And it didn't make sense to me. And also to be clear, I don't equate IQ with all there is to intelligence. And I have this theory of personal intelligence, but this is not an interview about me, so I'm not going to get into this. But
I've been inspired by your work, man, and like so this is an opportunity to thank you for that work and to, you know, recognize you and others that are a part of the small growing movement of academics/activists, because I see you as both growing academic activist community that's trying to ask a different question about people. You know, the old school question was, how smart are you? Let's measure it under the IQ test. The new question is, how are you smart? And let's build a set of metrics and tools that allow everyone to find that spark of genius inside of themselves. And you're a big part of that movement, man.
Well, thank you for saying that. I got chills when I heard you just describe the problem and articulate it. So there's probably a reason why I got chills. there's a commonality of a spirit that we both, you know, sort of see a better world. So it's wonderful. So now you did something really awesome. You took the short bus intentionally around the country, and you wanted to learn from people with all sorts of different ways of all different kinds of minds. What, I mean, that's kind of that's quite brilliant.
Yeah, so you know, to situate that journey, and it was a journey, you know, within you know, both my personal arc of transformation, but what I think is also a conceptual arc of transformation and a set of ideas about what leads to transformation if you've been demeaned. You know, I went to Brown and to reference a conversation we were having a moment ago, I wasn't just normal, but I was better than normal, right? Like I was better than those kids that got to go to the NAEP program. I was better than those kids who told me I was stupid. I had proved them all wrong, right? Yes. And not only did I go to Brown and do that whole thing, but I had a pretty, you know, exceptional journey at Brown. You know, I sold Learning Outside the Lines to Simon & Schuster. Dave Cole and I did when we were undergraduates. We took a full semester off and wrote it as undergraduates. I also founded Eye to Eye, which went off to be a national mentoring and advocacy organization, still in existence, been around for over 20 years. And I was a Harry S. Truman Scholar for Public Service, you know, one of, you know, 40 in the country out of all the universities in the country. And so I graduated from Brown, and, you know, on the surface, you know, it was like, oh, okay, you know, your journey's done, you know, like you made it, man.
Yeah.
And then why the hell do I feel like such shit? And I was in a place in my early, late 20s where I struggled still deeply with depression. I struggled with anxiety. I called it the black hole days where, you know, I'd be just walking down the street, man, I'd fall into a hole, you know, and
oh, not, I know that feeling. I know that feeling. Yeah.
Not come out for 2 weeks, you know? And then
goes out to you.
Yeah, man. Well, and it goes out to anyone listening.
Everyone. You know, yeah. Everyone has that feeling. Yeah.
Everyone has those, especially if you've been called not normal, because there's a wound there
and there's a deep wound.
Existential wound.
Existential. I love that. Yeah.
You know, and the wound is, its origin is being cut from the herd, you know, like in medieval time and biblical culture, in deep human DNA, the worst punishment was excommunication from the community. And I think that what we who have been excommunicated from the community of normal are having to heal from is a deep wound. So for me, I thought that the success traditionally would heal that wound. It did not. And not only did it not, but then I found myself as I started to speak and talk about my experiences, which started in the early 2000s, I found my story being really contorted to almost like reinforce a sense of shame for people who couldn't succeed in the way that I did. So I would give these talks at schools, and I literally was introduced on multiple occasions to kids in special education programs who were struggling and suffering. I was introduced by teachers, principals, etc., as somebody who used to be like them and somebody who had fixed himself and was now normal. That's almost a direct quote from introductions that would happen in front of children. So here I am thinking, you know what? I'm a part of the problem now. And what's going to help me heal? And what is the wound at its core?
Yes.
And the wound at its core was feeling deficient because I was different and having to understand that. So I went on a journey to try to figure out how to heal myself, how to not be a part of the problem and be a part of the solution around how we treat difference. And so I bought an old short school bus and I drove around the United States, 45,000 miles, 6 months. Mm-hmm. And I listened to the stories of people with atypical brains and bodies. And not only did I listen, but I learned from them. And I came to the realization that people who find themselves outside of the bell curve have knowledge about how to live a better life that all of us need, that I needed from a very deeply personal perspective. But ultimately, I think they have knowledge about how to live with the reality of human embodiment, the reality of human difference, the reality of human fallibility. There's a saying in the disability rights movement that we are all temporarily abled bodies. I would add temporarily abled bodies and minds, that we will all experience disability at some point in our life. And we need to learn how to live with that human reality because we've been in denial of that human reality for too long. So that's what I found on the short bus, man. I found a better way to live.
That's wonderful. You know, if I can just like reframe the not reframe it, but just try to think about it through my own personal experience. I feel like I went through this this shift of like my 20s being like, I'll prove them, you know, like with my own sort of like trying to get all the accolades I possibly could, the achievements. And I felt deeply empty as well. And then the shift seems to be from that attitude to like, you know, like a more selfless, egoless sort of like, you know, I'm going to like help others who are in a similar position. And that just feels better.
And it's you know, it's, I tell you, so I
it feels less narcissistic, first of all.
It's less narcissistic. It's less capitulating to the story of normal that to be valuable, you have to be that impossible ideal.
Exactly.
Which you never can be, but keep trying. But it's ultimately how human beings heal. You know, when you were speaking, came to mind an experience that I had with Eye to Eye. So I've alluded to Eye to Eye a few times. And it started as a tiny little mentoring program, bunch of Brown University students with learning and attentional differences and some RISD students who mentored younger students who had similar experiences. And it started with the notion that, you know, me, David Cole, others sharing their story with young kids would give those young children a sense of hope for their future, right? And yes, it would heal them in some way. And it absolutely did that. But the first evaluation we had done at Eye to Eye, when Eye to Eye started to go to scale in the early 2000s by Harvard's Graduate School of Education, the evaluation done by Harvard showed that the impact was as much or more on the person doing the mentoring because it let them give back.
Yes.
But more importantly, it let them make meaning from their experience that created positive change in the world, opposed to consuming the gold stars and reaching for those gold hoops and jumping through them. This was a way to change things.
Yes.
For a young person, but ultimately the work that you're doing, the work that that so many of us who care about this issue, to change the world, to make it a place where no one feels stupid, crazy, lazy, no one feels defective because they're different.
Oh, it's wonderful. Now, are you one of the founders of Eye to Eye?
Yeah, so I founded Eye to Eye at Brown as the mentoring program, and then co-founded Eye to Eye with David Flink, hired David Flink when he was still working at Brown University.
David, right?
Yeah, David Flink, yeah.
Yeah,
to come and build Eye to Eye out. So I was the co-founder, the founding executive director, and then president emeritus.
Tell them to put you on their website as part of their origin story. What the heck?
I know. One of the
Why
things,
are you excluded from this website?
One of the things that is...
Talk about exclusions, jeez.
Yeah, you know, you have to create space for other people to do
I know.
To do the work, man. And so I'm all good.
I love that. Yes, I tested you. I tested to see if your growth, and you passed. You passed. So do you know Gabrielle Friedman?
I don't think I know Gabrielle.
Oh, sorry, Friedman. Gabe. Sorry, Gabe Friedman.
No, I don't know Gabe Friedman.
Okay, he works for Eye to Eye now. I think he's pretty high up in the organization. But his sister was in my class at Penn, and she got me in touch with him. And I got a little bit of a window into Eye to Eye. I didn't even know you were associated with it, let alone a co-founder of it. And it struck me how amazing the organization was and how impactful it was for so many. So I think if that was your only accomplishment in life, I think that that's all that, you've really done something really important.
Oh, right on, man. Well, and it is not the I, but the we. It's the multiple people, from David Flink, who was one of the first mentors at Brown, to David Cole, who is also not in the origin story, but was the co-founder at Brown, and Marcus, who both David and I hired, who's now the president. And then even beyond those people, it's the mentors all around the country who I meet in my travels, who are out there, sharing what makes them different proudly with courage, that helps take down this idea that there's a normal way to be. And it's those people who will really make an impact every day.
Oh, I love it. Oh boy. So, okay. Is there anything else, we could talk for hours and hours and hours. Is there anything else you want to say? We didn't really talk about, how societies, governments, businesses can promote more neurodiverse people, like sort of a practical suggestion. Do you want to kind of leave with something along those lines?
Yeah. I mean, you're right, Scott, to name the next horizon of our work. And again, it's our work. It's your work. It's my work. It's your listeners' work. It's our work to demand that we have systems that embrace neurodiversity and unleash the talent and value that those humans bring to the world. We have a long way to go in school, but the conversation and systems are at least in place to do that work in school. We have a further way to go in the private sector and in the workforce. And that matters, because we know that a lot of what happens in K-12 education is reverse engineered by what private sector demands and what helps people thrive in the private sector, which makes sense because people need to make a living and make their way. And if the private sector could take a stance on neurodiversity mattering, that would impact and ripple down and throughout our system. And so from a very practical perspective, this is something that I'm advocating for in all of my travels. I hope many will join me. We have to include within private sector corporate diversity policies different brains and bodies as a part of the diversity initiatives. I go to a lot of corporations, and the conversation around learning and attentional differences or disabilities, autism or Asperger's, is being had through a compliance ADA lens, right?
Yes.
But then you go over to the other side, and the conversation around inclusion and access around race, class, gender, sexual identity and orientation, that's about diversity, right? So that's wrong. It's not wrong that we are having a conversation around diversity, but we need to include in that conversation around diversity and in the policy, procedures, and practices of those diversity initiatives, we have to include the neurodiverse, and I'll go further. We have to include people with atypical brains and bodies as a part of diversity, as a part of what makes any business, any school, any community stronger, and as people who have something to give, not despite their differences, but they have something to give because of their differences.
Jonathan, why do I feel like I'm in a church sermon right now? I just want to be like, oh, man.
Yeah, I get riled up, man. That happens.
I feel like every like sentence you're saying, I'm like, amen, brother. Hallelujah. Hey, John, thank you so much. The world is very lucky and fortunate to have you in it, and to really make such important strides. And I feel very fortunate to be able to talk to you today. So thanks so much for being on the Psychology Podcast.
Yeah, hey man, the world's a better place because of you, the work that you do. Thank you for having me, and let's all share our different, and let's fight for a world where different isn't deficient together.
Hallelujah. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the podcast on iTunes and subscribe to the Psychology Podcast YouTube channel, as we're really trying to increase our viewership on YouTube. In fact, many of these episodes are in video format on YouTube, so you'll definitely want to check out that channel. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.